the clock is nice and accurate. K2RIW here. My name is Dick. Stand by a minute. Okay. I see what the difference is. I forgot to put on the speech processor. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. The TechNet meets most Sunday evenings for the last 32 and a fraction years, starting at 8 o'clock, and it is a gathering of the clan. It's a gathering of people who are curious about radio and they want to know more about how it works. And so they educate each other. So the major purpose of the TechNet is education. From my point of view, the schools do a less than mediocre job of teaching useful engineering information about wireless technology. The books do a slightly better job, but still when hams talk to each other about their own experiences of tinkering in the backyard with an antenna, with a transmission line, building a transmitter, building a receiver, doing work with satellites, moonbound, meteor scatter, and echo link, and so on. There's 26, 27 different kinds of ham radio. Let me drop. And the one you're listening to right now, 2 meter FM radio, it's just one of the 26 kinds. So before, if you become disappointed with this hobby, before giving it up, make sure you try one of the other 25 kinds. My major interest are the frequencies above 400 megacycles. And that occasionally includes 2 meters. I've done some 2 meter sideband work and 432 sideband work. A person signs into the technical net because he does have a question or a comment. You need not sign in just because you're listening. After 32 years, we believe somebody is listening. It's sort of been convinced to us a long time ago. The very loose schedule that we follow is that for the first hour or so, not necessarily always an hour, depending on the amount of enthusiasm, we drop. People sign in with their general questions of general interest to ham radio operators. That's followed by John KC2WGB, who handles the mailbag. So for the potential hams, or the hams that don't yet have the right equipment, or don't yet have their license, and they're in the process of working on that license, when they've got questions, they send John a communication of some kind. Email, snail mail, pigeon droppings, whatever. He also monitors the Echo Link website. So if you've had trouble signing in because we're a little bit too quick on the trigger, we're all supposed to wait for the 4 beeps in between each transmission. We're supposed to make our transmissions not much more than a minute long. So if you time out and or don't give time for the 4 beeps between transmissions, the whole system doesn't get reset correctly, and sometimes the Echo Link people get locked out. John, by monitoring that website, knows about that taking place, and also there's methods by which through Echo Link you can send a message to John, KC2WGB. Let me drop. After the mailbag section, which last week we had an extremely provocative question that was asked by a female amateur, and that is to say, does gravity affect electrons? Does electricity have weight? Do electrons have weight? That was the sort of the general nature of the question. And that discussion, which almost got to the point of an argument, I got pretty hot and heavy, went on for about an hour and a half, and we almost agreed to disagree at the end of that discussion. That particular subject being so provocative, it got picked up again Monday night and went on for another hour and a half. And so the compendium of opinion we came to on Sunday night and the compendium of opinion we came to with the experts that appeared on Monday were two different opinions. The situation is not thoroughly settled, as you can tell. I also believe, let me drop. I think there was a flea market somewhere in the metro area. We'd like to hear some words about that. Okay, along the way, quite often we hear from Hal, K6DPZ, who has a lot of experience with a lot of radio equipment. I guess I forgot to mention Paul, N2S, WS2J. Here we go. Boy, am I good tonight. WS2N. Paul has been studying what NASA does for the last zillion years. And as you know, a major event is coming up this coming Tuesday at around, I think it's roughly 9 o'clock at night. The New Horizons spacecraft, launched, I think, in the year 2007, is at something like 30,000-40,000 miles an hour, going by whizzing by what used to be the planet Pluto, going to take a zillion pictures of Pluto and all its moons, and it's going to gather so much data. But because it is something like 8 billion miles away, that data has to be sent at a very slow rate, and it's going to take something in the vicinity of 160 days to downlink all of the data that's going to be recorded during that 7,000-mile whiz-bang. I mean, whiz-by. Here we go. It's going to be passing the body called Pluto at around 7,500 miles away and taking lots of pictures. Already the pictures has taken are higher in resolution because of its closeness than we've gotten from Hubble. Let me drop. So Paul would be telling us about that right after Eric. I mean, right after John tells us the mailbag situation. And with whatever time's left over, we might re-pick up the subject of do electrons, do separate protons, neutrons, and electrons, when they're not necessarily part of an atom, do they have weight? They certainly have mass. Do they have weight? Can you literally measure the weight of the electricity traveling through a wire? It's, as I said, a very provocative question. Not a simple one to answer, as you're going to find out. Okay, at this time, I'm going to take check-ins. I've already got Joe, W-H-O-R-Y-Y, as a carryover from last week, as a check-in. Do we have anyone else who does have a question or a comment? Please give me your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. K2LIW. Sign in right now.
WB2QEQ, Len. Question on antenna tuners.
KB2HEC, Steve, and yes.
Okay, we've got Joe, Len, and Steve in that order. Anyone else? Give me your call letters and name right now. K2LIW on the tech net.
WS2N, Paul, and we do have a space report tonight. Back to you, sir.
Gee, I wonder, Paul, is anything exciting going to be going on this week in space? That's a joke, because of this this major event that we're all looking forward to. The two next major events that I'm curious about, of course, is New Horizons, and when we eventually launch space telescope, the infrared space telescope, the James Webb Space Telescope, which I think it's launched in the year 2018. That's going to be one hell of a piece of hardware. Very complicated. I hope it goes smoothly with a lot of capability. Okay, let's see what Joe's got to say. Joe, W-H-O-R-Y-Y, go right ahead. K-2-R-I-W in the text net.
Good evening, Dick, W-H-O-R-Y. This might be just a simple question, but we'll see how it goes. It's about a dipole. Specifically, it's going to be an 80-meter dipole, but I'm going to add more sections to it. But here's the question, and this might also fit into other people's categories, too, as far as thinking about something like this, that don't have a lot of room to stretch a dipole end-to-end on their property. I do, but I want to just explore the possibility of what would happen if you look at the dipole horizontally from straight up, and you have two legs of the dipole, say, going one east, one west, normally. So the radiation goes up, and it goes to the north, and it goes to the south, but having the minimum radiation going to the east and to the west. That's how I basically understand how the thing is going to be. What would happen if you take that, looking from at the center point where you feed the antenna, and instead of the dipole elements going out 180 from each other, you bring one element in so it's less than 90 degrees, say like 70 degrees or 60 degrees, because of maybe physical requirements where you can't stretch a dipole end-to-end across your property. But you have two other points you can anchor the two legs of the dipole to successfully and still keep the balance in one specific space. What's this going to do to the dipole, number one, and are there any pros and cons to doing something like this? Back to you.
When you build almost any kind of an antenna where you intend to do transmitting with it, the seven words that are the most important words to you as an antenna designer, antenna builder, are the following seven words. You resonate first, then it will radiate. Now, the word resonate could mean that the antenna itself hits resonance, or by way of the antenna tuner, you've connected to the antenna, which is the wrong size. With the antenna tuner's help, you forced it into resonance. So resonance of the dipole is your highest priority. Electrically making it a half wave long if you don't intend to put an antenna tuner nearby. And I think that's your case. You'd like the antenna to be a standalone, not necessarily being a force to be used in antenna tuner. Now, within that realm of resonance, you can do all kinds of crazy things with the antenna. You can take the wire and stretch it the old-fashioned way, horizontal, parallel to the ground, feed it in the center, and you can feed it halfway off from the center toward the end and the outer end. But the dipole itself, you can keep it resonant, but zigzag it left and right, up and down, wind it in a helical form, put a loading coil in the bottom, the middle, the top, top hat capacitors. There's all kinds of things you can do. And if you readjust the length accordingly, you reestablish resonance. So once you've got a resonant structure, the next thing that really counts about the antenna pattern is where is the maximum current flowing. If you look inside of any of the antenna modeling programs, let me drop. You'll find out that almost all of these programs, like NEC and Mini-NEC and High Frequency Structure Simulator and HST, I think it is, Microwave Studio. Take a look at any of these antenna modeling programs. Yagi Max, I think, is another one. You'll find out that what the program does is to take the radiator, break it up into a whole lot of fine little chunks, goes through an iterative process by which it eventually arrives at what amount of current is flowing through each one of those chunks. Then the current flowing through each one of those chunks, as in one direction, the magnetic field wraps around that section of wire, and you know which direction the current flows. As you start zigzagging the antenna, as you start tilting it down because it's an inverted V, or it's a V or an inverted V, and you can make the top view to be a traveling wave V-like antenna, you do make changes to the antenna pattern, but you'd be amazed how slow the antenna pattern changes. As you twist those elements in various ways, you still have maximum current flowing in the center. The polarity of the current flowing in the center is the dominant factor telling you where most of the radiation pattern is. But the nulls that you normally get off the end of a pure flat-out dipole, let me drop. There's a whole lot of ways that you can make those nulls disappear. An inverted V, for instance, will make the nulls off the ends disappear. And it's the inverted V has another crazy effect. You look at the inverted V broadside, it is just about a purely horizontally polarized wave. It radiates in that direction. You look at the inverted V end view, the majority of what you see out of that antenna is vertically polarized. And you can sort of see why. That from that point of view, you project the wire that you see, and you only see the vertical component of the wire. And so you see primarily vertically polarization off the end. If you're at a 45-degree angle from broadside, you're now seeing some horizontal and some vertical. And the exact polarization you radiate out of a HF antenna, to some degree, is academic, because by the time that signal goes a long distance, like to your buddy in London or Tokyo or whatever, and it's gone through the ionosphere a couple of times with a couple of bounces between ionosphere and ground, each path through the ionosphere is going through a gyrotropic material. Let me drop it. That ionosphere is a plasma. In other words, it's got the ions. In other words, some of the electrons have been removed from some of those nucleuses of those air molecules in the ionosphere. So this conductive substance called plasma mixed in with the Earth's magnetic field. Whenever you have a plasma plus magnetic field, a radio wave going through it experiences something called Faraday rotation. The signal starts rotating in polarization. I don't know the exact number, but on 80 meters, by the time your signal gets from your antenna to your buddy in London, maybe it has rotated 5 times in polarization. And the crazy thing about this Faraday rotation is it does not obey reciprocity. You send your signal from Long Island to London, it'll rotate clockwise some number of turns. Your buddy sends a signal from London back to Long Island. It rotates counterclockwise a different number of turns. Therefore, you can easily have a horizontally polarized signal you launch to London. He sees it as a vertical. He launches a vertical signal to you, and it comes into your location as a vertical signal after some rotations. Craziness, of course. So it's a little bit difficult to really predict the pattern and polarization as you start zigzagging the wires in various ways. But the center of the wire is the dominant portion of it. If I took the outer 40%, let me drop. If I took the outer 40% of your dipole and bent them straight down, straight up, left, right, clockwise, zigzag them, and whatever, it would have a rather minor effect on polarization of the signal and the antenna pattern. So the modeling programs will help you predict what's going to happen. But one of the things that will amaze you, Joe, from my experience, is that as you take the outer, let me pick a number, outer two-thirds of your dipole from center, left side outer two-thirds, right side outer two-thirds, and you start bending it in funny ways, you'll make a rather minor change in antenna pattern and polarization. But the majority happens in the center. Most of the antennas that you and I have ever worked on, if you calculate, if you first figure out where's the maximum current flowing, say for instance you've got a loop antenna, and where's the maximum current flowing if I've got a vertical loop, all the maximum current might be at the bottom because that's where I'm feeding it, and I've got a loading capacitor at the top. And if it's a full one wavelength loop, in that particular case, looking at the loop in view, you'll have primarily vertical polarization. And the magic of a loop antenna is it tends to radiate in the plane of the loop. And you would think it's going to radiate at right angles to the loop. It does, but it's got a different signal strength in that direction. I know I haven't quite answered your question. I've given you some of the raw ingredients, said Joe. Why don't you repose your question one more time? Let's see if we can get closer to the truth. After that, I'm going to pass it over to the group to see if other people have got experience with doing what you're about to do or what you're mentally thinking about doing, and maybe they can tell us what results they've seen. W-H-U-R-Y-Y. Really digging into dipoles. And there's a good reason to do that. I'll tell you on the next transmission. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, did you forget to have a comment?
Not sure if somebody else is. Somebody else in there?
Yeah, Rich is in there, and after you make your comments, I'm going to then pass it over to Rich. Go ahead, Joe.
Okay, very good. Well, say you make the antenna 90 degrees. One element goes east-west, one element's going north-south. So one half of your antenna is going to be radiating east and west. The other one is going to be radiating basically north and south. Maybe some off the end. I understand with a inverted V, it's whether the feed point is higher or lower than your end supports. I understand it's going to have a partial vertical component in that direction. But say you take the antenna and go further than 90 degrees, maybe you fold it in so it's at 70 degrees or 60 degrees because you happen to have feed points available away from the feed point of the antenna where you can comfortably put an antenna like that. That's basically what I'm getting at with this whole discussion. You know, taking an antenna and purposely making the thing a lot less than 180, maybe even as much as 60 degrees separation, or even less than that. Is it going to start, as the antenna comes around, is it going to start acting more like a dipole again? And the other part of the question is, do each half the antenna, will they affect each other as far as its length or tuning adjustments now that you do something like this? Back to you.
Yeah, now that I understand a little bit more about what you're asking, I've got a bunch of suggestions on this one. But Rich maybe has already been there, I bet you, with some of the QFP operations he's done on mountaintops. Let's see what Richard's got to say. K2, Uncle Papa Sierra. I'm going to guess somewhere in Pennsylvania. K2RIW. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, Danny. It's K2UPS Mobile. I'm still up in Ohio, heading towards Pennsylvania, near Cambridge, Ohio. About 45 minutes away from Wheeling, West Virginia. My comment to Joe is, I believe what he's talking about was not what you were initially getting into, like making it a Z shape, but more of a V shape, where the elements are straight, they're only bent at the C point, where it's not 180 degrees apart. I'm also assuming that he's keeping the elements level with the ground, parallel. It's not a, the ends are not drooping down, but the ends are going to be at the same height as the C point. Since most of us can't get an 80-meter dipole up at the ideal half wavelength or higher above ground to get an efficient pattern, you know, if it's only 30 or 40 feet up, I really don't think you're going to see much difference in the pattern. But once you get up to the proper level, it's my understanding that bringing the legs closer together, like he's saying, maybe 90 degrees or so, you're going to get directivity in the narrow portion of it. It's like called a V-beam if you put multiple elements like that together. Now, if you start bringing them closer than 90, like even as much as 60, I believe you're going to start getting some interaction with the two halves of the dipole that will affect the radiation pattern and tuning. I have not tried it, but from what I have read and understand of that, I think that's what's going to happen. But if it's not going to be at the optimum height, you could change that angle around, and I don't think it's going to make much difference in the long run, Dick, back to net.
You brought up a very good point, Rich, the so-called V-beam. And I'm trying to remember the name of the company, a very famous antenna company for television aerials. I had a V-beam television aerial, something about 8 or 9 elements to it, which worked very well on channel 2 through 13. And that was way back in the late 60s, early 70s, in which we were using that antenna. Channel Master traveling wave, traveling V antenna. Turns out that as you start taking ordinary dipole with the left side and right side 180 degrees apart, and you start bringing them together, in Joe's first example, one half the dipole is from center going toward one tip going toward north, and from center the other tip is going toward east. The bisector of that angle would be northeast. You would develop a little bit of extra directivity to the northeast and to the southwest. The inverted, the V-beam antenna does give you a little bit of extra directivity in that direction, a little stronger lobe at the bisector angle, if you know what I mean, both forward and reverse. And I think it favors forward, I think, yes. The rhombic antenna has some of this characteristic. It favors forward, although the rhombic gets the majority of its front-to-back ratio by way of the terminating resistor. Let me drop. So if you view it in the bisector angle on Joe's north and east half dipole, to the northeast you're going to get the strongest signal. If you view it from other angles, you're still looking at wider side view, and you're going to be getting some energy in that direction, although a little bit weaker. As you start exaggerating it, as you start bringing that 90-degree angle of the east, of the north and east dipole toward a 60-degree and a 40-degree and a 30-degree angle, you don't necessarily get more directivity because you don't have the real estate. By that I mean real directivity comes from real estate and interferometry, and your projected area of radiating antenna doesn't have a lot of angle to it, so it's not going to have a lot of directivity. The Q of the antenna will go up as you bring the two sides together. In the most exaggerated case, you bring them together so that it now becomes a piece of 600 ohm open wire line, if you know what I mean. Now it'll radiate not at all. It'll have extremely high Q because, as far as the antenna is concerned, it thinks it's a piece of open wire 600 ohm line with an open circuit at the end, an infinite standing wave ratio, and now you'll have very little radiation. So the Q of the antenna is going to continuously and slowly increase as you narrow up that angle between the two sides. You're about to ask, is there a great advantage of doing this? Let me drop it. In the case of a V-beam, there is some advantage of making the element V-shaped top view, horizontally polarized beam. It does make a slight improvement in directivity and a little bit of difference as far as bandwidth is concerned on covering multiple bands for a television aerial, multiple frequencies. But for we amateurs to do that, go ahead and do it if that's the only support you've got. It's not going to catch on fire and stop working, but it's a less than ideal situation in my point of view. what little you gain in directivity as you first start coming from 180 degrees toward 90 degrees is simultaneously going to be met with a slightly increasing Q as you do it. Therefore, the signal has to bounce around a lot more before it finally gets radiated. As long as you're resonating, and as long as there really is some projected area of wire, in other words, when you look down the throat of the antenna, in the case I was describing now, the so-called bisectional angle, the amount of cross-sectional wire that you see in that projected view is what's really giving you the signal that you see in that direction. And as you really bring the wires together, so it becomes a piece of 600-ohm line, 600-ohm open wire line, you can see that the horizontally projected wire that you see goes to zero. There will be no radiation in that case. It becomes a pure open wire transmission line with pure reflection at the end and almost no radiation. So go ahead and do it at reasonably wide angles, Joe. I don't recommend going down to numbers like 30 and 60 degrees because you're now moving in the direction of a tapered open wire transmission line, which doesn't necessarily radiate very well. That's a bunch of opinions. I haven't really done this particular one. Let's see. Drag your feet as they pass it back to you, Joe, to see if other people have read or done experiments along these lines. W2RYY with some delay. K2RYW in the TechNet. Looks like you've got it, Joe.
Okay, Dick. So for what you're saying, even bringing something down to like something like 60 degrees might start causing a problem because, you know, I couldn't put the thing up 90 degrees. I can't do that. Well, I guess I probably could. I'd have to shift one of the mounting structures quite differently than where I have it right now. I'd actually put the two ends like 90 degrees if I was going to do that. But you said to try to avoid going much less than 90 degrees and approaching a thing at an angle like 60 degrees would start becoming a problem. What would you say in case somebody wants to do this or they need to do this because they don't have a physical room? What would you, just an estimate, what do you think the minimum number of degrees you could go before you start really having a problem where it's not going to work very well? Back to you.
This is a very slow, continuous condition that you're describing, Joe. It doesn't suddenly stop working at some number of degrees. As you bring the two sides closer and closer together in angle, the Q continues to increase simply because the amount of projected wire that you see at the bisectional angle is starting to decrease. So you're radiating less and less signal on the first pass, so to speak. And therefore the Q is increasing, the bandwidth goes down, the radiation. If you can live with the high Q, you're still going to radiate all your power. So therefore, ultimately, the signal strength in the desirable direction will come close to what it used to be. Off the sides, where you used to have a null, you won't have a null. It becomes a little bit more omnidirectional than the antenna. The major disadvantage, as I see it, is increasing Q, decreasing bandwidth. And as long as you do resonate it and you're using low-loss materials, the extra Q, which means the signal bounces more often, as long as you've got very low-loss, good copper, it's not going to get hot, it's not going to dissipate the power, it's going to work. So my gut feel is that beyond going less than 60 degrees, you're starting to get into the area where the Q is going up fast enough that you're going to start suffering some amount of loss, I squared R loss, in your copper. As long as you, and by the way, the impedance will also be, let me think about that now, which way will the impedance go, up or down? Now, this is a case where the Bradley-Woodward curves might not have covered it. They did cover triangular-shaped radiators as well as linear radiators. And is there a section where they studied the amount of signal radiated from signals with an acute angle like you're describing?
Repeater, time out.
At my leisure, Joe, I'm going to be taking a look at Chapter 4. Of most of the issues of the Antenna Engineering Handbook. That's where the Brown and Woodward curves exist. And did they cover this situation? I'm not sure. So we'll look into it a little bit further. I don't think we got the end answer, but I can tell you what the trends are. Back to you for any final on this one, Joe. W2RYY, interesting question. K2.
quick comment, Dick?
Go ahead, John.
KCQWGB. Dick, a good way to examine exactly what you were talking about, a couple of years ago I did an experiment with a simple pair of rabbit ear antennas, set them up as a V-beam horizontally, and had them at 180 degrees open fully, similar to a dipole, and then closed it, and watched that on a vector network analyzer, and you can see the effect almost exactly as you were describing it.
Give us a few more words on that one, John. The effect, as I described it, what did you see the trace, I presume you were sweeping frequency, and you displayed tracing it on a Smith chart, or maybe an XY plot, but I'm going to guess it was a Smith chart on your vector network analyzer. And my guess is the center of the antenna, in other words, the center frequency, where you normally go fairly close to the center of the Smith chart, my guess is that started drifting away from the Smith chart, and my guess is the curly Q of it, so to speak, started curling up a little bit faster. In other words, that's one of the ways of representing higher Q. Is that approximately what you remember seeing when you looked at that Smith chart as you did that experiment? Darn good experiment. Go ahead, John.
Yes, Dick. As I close the angle up, 90 degrees seems to be very similar to all the V-beams in operation. 120 degrees was a little better, but when I went past 90 degrees, if I got near 60 degrees, then you saw that effect that you were speaking about, and I believe the impedance was going up as I closed them, and it got to what looked like a transmission line if you went with the two elements parallel. So that's what I remember. It was quite a while ago, but it was an interesting experiment.
Yeah, that seems to want. I heard somebody else. We'll pick you up in a second. That seems to fit what I was guessing at. As you bring the wires parallel to each other, make the angle smaller and smaller, you're essentially creating 600 ohm open wire line, 400 ohm open wire line, depending on the real spacing. Now it's a transmission line as opposed to a radiator. It's a quarter wave long transmission line. Quarter wave long transmission line tends to give you impedance inversion. So that you've got an open circuit at the tips of the dipoles, and therefore a quarter wave away, you're going to see something like a very low impedance. Huh. The person that wanted to join us, give us your call letters and name, and KQLIW in the TechNet.
It's Ray, KQMMY. I don't know, can you hear me? It's on this AC.
I'm hearing you rather well, Ray. So, as long as you're not in the Bronx, I'll hear you very well. I'm having fun with him. Go ahead, Ray. We're hearing you.
Yep. Dick, Roger. I saw this on YouTube. You could actually take an AM or FM receiver, standard broadcast band, and start off parallel with the wires, like John was saying, and then start spreading them apart, and you will see at what angle you'll start to actually receive signals. So that's a good check. You can just manually do it with a regular receiver, and the wires don't have to be long at all. And as soon as you reach a certain angle, you'll see the reception will start to come in. Throw it on YouTube. You can YouTube it and check that out. And that'll give you an idea of the degree.
The one thing that's not clear to me, Ray, the radio receiver that you were using, or they were using on this YouTube video, was this an AM broadcast receiver? Around one megacycle, or was it a FM broadcast receiver around 100 megacycles? Which was it, Ray? Go ahead.
I don't remember, Dick. I know the guy was making a point with the antenna where he had it parallel. You know, it wasn't that long of an antenna, so maybe it was FM. So FM is a higher frequency, shorter antenna. And as soon as he started spreading those two lines apart, it started to act like a dipole, and reception came in. So that's the best I could do.
Okay, good enough, Ray. One more point of where somebody actually did the experiment. And so maybe Joe's going to do the experiment. Now, the nice thing about antennas is they scale beautifully. You take the best 80-meter dipole you've ever built, And because your laboratory is very well tuned with the test equipment you own, where you can do an experiment of 1,000 megs, and 80 meters versus 1,000 megs is, I guess, about a 100-to-1 ratio in frequency, or a little bit more. As long as you scale every single dimension proportional to the new wavelength, the antenna will give you the exact same performance in gain, pattern, polarization. The only thing that's not going to be quite the same is effective capture area, but that's not the thing that the average guy measures. So you could scale an antenna. Joe, if he wanted to, his basement is more than big enough to build a 900 meg version of the antenna and scale it and put it on his test equipment by way of his service monitoring being used as a spectrum analyzer with directional couplers. He can make a poor man's vector network analyzer if he didn't already have one, his SiteMaster, that I think he has access to, but also allow him to do this. So to scale the antenna that he's really going to build on 80 or 40 meters, to scale it to 914, where the antenna is only 6 inches long, will give you the exact same results, and that's a good way to make the measurement. Back to you, Joe.
For the comment, Dick.
Go ahead, John.
One thing I forgot to mention is with the dipoles that you were with TV, they're extendable, the telescope, so you can have one a little shorter, and again, if you follow the percentage and scale it, you can also work those problems out too. So a lot of fun being able to change the length and to have the two lengths different, a lot of different patterns. I don't remember exactly what they were, but it was a lot of fun. Back to you, Dick.
Okay. Eric recognized. And by the way, Eric, the carrier is there, but the video is not there for the last 12 hours on Channel 21 local over-the-air broadcast. Maybe someone hasn't mentioned that to you. There's nothing magic about feeding the dipole in the center. If you make one arm longer than the other, you're just feeding the dipole off to one side. As long as you've got the right kind of a balancing device, you can feed it anywhere you want to. But I bet you've done some of these experiments, Eric. KE2EJ, K2LIW, the TechNet.
One, no, I wasn't aware, which means I'm going to go run and look in a second. Two, I was thinking about something. I was listening to your last discussion. And I know that when I go to make a small network of a capacitor, coil, and resistor, and I calculate the Q, I never take in the equivalent series resistance to the components itself. And I'm just wondering, in terms of these wire antennas, the diameter or the actual resistivity part of the antenna, does that have a similar effect to what I'm talking about, or you just don't consider it as a...
The I squared R loss of the antenna, if you've done a good job as an antenna designer, Eric, you've used relatively low material for the frequency range that you're working with. You and I are going to use 14-gauge copper wire on our 80 and 40-meter dipole, a highly conductive material, and you and I can put a kilowatt into it. By way of our thermal imaging camera, we'll find out that that wire, because of the current flowing through it and the skin effect, I'm guessing less than a watt or two is dissipated in the I squared R resistance of the wire. Of the kilowatt you and I put into it, 999 watts is going to be radiated. If you and I were foolish enough to build our 80-meter dipole out of nichrome wire or stainless steel wire, which has got a much higher resistivity than copper, now the amount of heating of the wire would go up pretty fast. So when it comes to the Q phenomenon because of conductivity with good materials, that's a secondary effect. Second of all, let me drop it. Your and my 80-meter dipole at a 14-gauge household wire, which is approximately an eighth of an inch in diameter, and we're talking about a wavelength here of 265 feet. How many wavelengths is the diameter of your wire? It's probably 1/10,000th of a wavelength. So until you start getting a very fat wire, like a bird-cage-like antenna, the diameter of the wire versus the radiated Q is going to change very slowly at first. However, when you then take it with a 900 megacycle antenna, as I have done, and now you make the radiating element, the dipole-like element, in the vicinity of a quarter inch or 3/8 of an inch wide out of sheet metal, and now you're approaching an eighth wave or a sixteenth of a wave of diameter. Now you get a huge change in the apparent Q. Got to be careful how you use the word Q now. When I'm talking about Q of this UHF sheet metal dipole, I'm talking about how broad is the bandwidth over which it gives me a fairly low standing wave ratio. That's the good kind of Q. You got to be separating the word Q from the way most people think about it. Most people think about Q as the quality factor of an LC network being used as a filter. And almost all of these antennas that you and I build, Eric, are not filters.
Yep. Ratio of resistance to reactance.
Okay. Of the seven different definitions of Q, bandwidth divided into center frequency is one of them. Current rise at resonance, voltage rise at resonance. Rate of change of phase versus frequency. Rate of change of reactance versus frequency. All of those are related to Q, and the Q goes down and is a huge advantage most of the time when you use broader diameter radiators, as long as you're now starting to approach an appreciable portion of a wavelength, like an eighth of a wavelength of diameter, you get a huge improvement. When you're starting off at 1/10,000th of a wavelength in diameter of your 80-meter dipole, and you decide to use double the diameter, you know, two or three pieces of 14-gauge wire instead of one, you'll measure a difference. But it's a very small difference, a very slow difference. You can get a hint about that, again, with those Brown and Woodward curves, is you start looking at the bottom of the chart, of the reactance chart. You start seeing that the slope of the reactance versus wavelength starts becoming a hell of a lot flatter. The Q goes down real fast. And let me drop it.
Hey, Dick, let me just put my 2 cents in here. I see 21-3, 21-4, and 21-5 on the air. That's the sub-channels that are broadcasting right now.
Beautiful. All right. It's all back in operation. Were you seeing it earlier today, Joe? Throughout most of the morning, I was not getting any video or audio or a electronic programming guide on those channels, even though I was getting the indication of strong carrier. Did you see those this morning, Joe?
I don't know. I'm looking at them right now, but usually I remember getting the station as 21-1, -2, and -3, not -3, -4, and -5.
I'll be back in a couple minutes. Okay, Tuesday.
If I said -3, 4, and 5, I'm wrong. I meant 1-1, 2, and 3. This morning, at my QTH, late last night and early this morning, all channel 21 was not giving me video or audio. Apparently, you didn't look at that time, Joe. Go ahead.
Oh, but if somebody changed the probe or something at the studio that changed the over-the-air signature, and you left your receiver on 21-1, it would go away. But I'm telling you right now, this stuff on 21-3, -4, and -5.
What's the nature of that programming? In the case of 24, this higher dash numbers, I thought there's only three dash numbers for 21. What kind of programming is on those higher dash numbers of channel 21? Joe, go ahead.
Just a minute, because when I transmitted blanks out my antenna, just a second. Okay. 21-3 is the standard programming. 21-4 is create, and 21-5 is whatever third channel is. It just looks like all three channels have moved up two spots. That's what it looks like to me.
Wow. And you're seeing 21-1, 2, and 3, normal programming, and then they seem to be repeated on 4, 5, and 6. Is that sort of what you're saying?
No, that's not what I'm saying. They moved on their assignments from where they usually are. I remember the program for this WLAW is 21-1, -2, and -3. -3 is what I was previously seeing on 21-1. -4 is what I was previously seeing on 21-2, and -5 is what I was previously seeing on 21-3. Do you understand now? They moved up two spots each.
Fantastic. What is now on 21-1 and 21-2 on your receiver?
The converter won't lock there. If I put 21-21 in, it immediately goes up to 21-3 as the first spot.
And I think you're saying that's a brand new response that you've just seen for the first time in the last day. Is that true, Joe?
Sure, because I've never seen the channel before. It's like all three channels have moved up. So I'm saying if you had your converter just sitting there on 21-1 and you didn't do a rescan, you wouldn't have a picture anymore.
Yeah, I wasn't smart enough to look for those other potential dash numbers. Good stuff. Joe and I do quite a bit of over-the-air television. Well, he does DXing. I haven't got my antenna up high enough these days, although I'm going to be correcting that sometime in the near future. Digital over-the-air television is a fun subject for people like us. Unfortunately, the range of digital over-the-air television is significantly smaller than the analog television used to be. We were promised by the FCC the range would be the same, and that turned out to be a bit of a fib. And for that reason, the majority of people are using non-over-the-air direct broadcast. They're using other techniques like satellite and cable. Okay.
Can I just ask you something else here?
We really have been on the subject long enough. Make it brief, Joe. Go ahead.
It's nothing to do with the subject. Okay. Best guess, what would you say I'm looking at when my antenna is aimed at 170 degrees? What country or what area? I know it's got to be South America because I think that's East of Central America. Would you agree?
170 degrees is east northeast. So I'm confused. Go ahead.
170 is not east northeast. It's 10 degrees east to south.
Okay. Isn't 0 degrees north?
Yeah. So 170 is 10 degrees east of south. I'm just asking you, just generally. I'm taking a rough guess. I think it's around, I think that's about the main body of South America, possibly some of the islands. The reason I'm asking is because I was picking up some analog TV from that direction earlier today, and I couldn't have identified the voice channel to know what language that was coming over the air, but I saw some indication of a fairly strong video carrier for a good couple of hours this afternoon.
Well, yeah, now I've got my orientation back. That's the Caribbean and or Rio de Janeiro area. Go ahead to Erica. Erica, did you see anything funny going on with over-the-air broadcast? You bet, Erica.
Yeah, they must have had some encoder problems. Actually, it could happen in the path. It's actually coming down from Syracuse. It comes down via IP, goes through a whole bunch of devices, which actually have the ability to strip and put the pieces back in. And I just called everybody. Nobody's answering their phone. So, let's see what happens. But you, having a converter box like you have, if you actually manually dial 21-3 or 21-4 or 5, you'll get it. But because you don't rescan and you have an older box that won't automatically flip when it sees a change, that's why you think it's not there.
When the particular material that's intended to be on 21-1 and 21-2 is not there, what actually makes the change to make that quasi-error occur, Eric? Is it a computer program that picks up a glitch? Is it a switch setting somewhere? What creates the change? What's your best guess on that one, Eric? Go ahead.
No guessing required, I can tell you precisely. Think of the TV station as that piece of Ethernet cable that you plug into the back of your computer. And every packet of data that comes by has an address header, which says where it's from, got a destination header that says where it's going to, and those are address values, okay? We call them in the TV land, we call it PID, or program identification. What is this packet that you can call a packet ID? What is this packet that follows? There's different kinds. There's
there's a number that's used to designate a video packet, a number that's used to designate an audio packet. And in between those packets, there are other things called a PMT, or a program management table, which has a list of data that gets sent to your tuner that says, this is 21.1, this is 21.2. What it's really doing is instructing the multiplexer which packets to look at. So you've got to get away from the idea of channelized TV as a 6 megahertz as a channel. So it's kind of like a computer. You can open up VLC or Windows Media Player and open up 10 of them and watch 10 different streams at the same time, all coming through the same piece of cable that hooks up to your computer. It's the same idea. So let me just drop. So, a piece of gear somewhere, they either had problems, and they managed to get it going back with the wrong information being entered. That's how it can come up, being 21, 3, 4, and 5. Or they went to an older program that was set up improperly, that's feeding those things into the multiplexer. Or one of the IP converters, which actually will restamp those PIDs, and it's restamping them with the wrong numbers. So most likely it's happening back up in Syracuse, but it could be happening on the path getting to Plainview. Get your RWK to that.
300 stuff, Eric. And I presume if the people you talked to were at their telephone and you gave them this information, at each one of these substations, I'm going to call them, they're able to look at the data and say, oh, yeah, that packet has the wrong address. Is that approximately what happens, Eric? Go ahead.
Well, if I was actually at the station, I have a piece of equipment that actually can look at what's going on with the stuff in Syracuse and every step along the way. Although that system's fully installed in New York, where they actually control everything for us. But I'm in the process now of expanding and including that system, so it's kind of like half working at the moment.
Okay, thank you for that information, Eric. We're going to go over now to Len, KB2. KB2QEQ. We're sorry we've kept you waiting this long, Len. And right ahead with your question. And if I have trouble hearing you over the repeater, I'm hearing you on the input, Len, so I'll just simply repeat your question. WB2QEQ, K2RAW in the TechNet. Len, are you still there? WB2QEQ, K2RAW in the TechNet. Okay, we'll go over to Steve, see if Glenn comes back a little bit later. KD2HUC, K2LAW. Go right ahead, Steve.
Good evening, Dick, TechNet. Dick, my question for you guys tonight is on a dipole, a fan dipole that I just purchased. It's the Alpha Delta DXCC. I've done some research online, and my first question is, do you require a one-to-one balun when using this antenna? Looking online, some people say yes, some people say no, and I'm trying to steer clear of old wives' tales. So that's the simple question. Let me let it drop. The second question is, if I do require a balun, I'm going to need to put it down towards the bottom of the mast. And I know in previous discussions, anything between the balun and a dipole, you now have to factor in the length of the cable because some of the signal is going to come back down on the shield. My question is, if a balun is required and I put it at the bottom, does running the coax within the mast affect the operation of the cable that now the outside of the cable is part of the radiator and it's enclosed within the mast? So, that's my question. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, that's a beauty, Steve. And you're probably going to enjoy the answer. First of all, any dipole, whether it be a fan dipole or a single dipole in one band, can you feed it with the direct piece of transmission line coax cable where the center conductor goes to the right side and the shield goes to the left side? Will it work? Absolutely. So any dipole, fan dipole or regular dipole, can be fed without a balun. And it's not going to crash and burn. The worst situation, you might have some RF in the shack, but even then, that's a little bit on the rare side these days. So you're going to radiate. You're going to radiate well if your transmission line went alongside of the neighbor's apartment because you're in an apartment building. He's now going to be getting some stronger signal because he's near that cable that's radiating, and has television interference and radio interference, and maybe phonograph interference, and maybe cordless phone interference is going to increase. Since everybody's using digital these days, I don't even know it, if you know what I mean. Minor factor as I see it. Putting a balun in stops that signal from going down the transmission line. And even if you don't think you can afford a real balun, and the most desirable place to put the balun is right at the antenna, because any length of transmission line between the antenna and the balun is going to be part of that additional radiation going on. A poor man's balun, where you just take a 3, 4, or 5 turns of the coax cable, maybe a foot in diameter, and tape it together right near the antenna, that will serve the prime purpose. That is a kind of an RF choke, and exactly how much RF choking you're getting out of that, if you care to be a real scientist, you can calculate it. X number of turns, X diameter, you go to the appropriate page of the Radio Amateur's Handbook. Let me drop them. There's a formula in there that will allow you to calculate how many microhenries you're going to get out of that many turns of wire of that diameter of the coil. And once you know the number of microhenries and you know the frequency you're operating at, you can calculate the amount of capacitor the inductive reactance. And if you're using 50-ohm cable, and if you had more than 50 ohms of inductive reactance, you're starting to get a pretty good RF choke. And if you could make it 10 to 1 or 500 ohm inductive reactance, now it's a perfect RF choke. So building this balun in the right place is not too difficult, and buy or building it. Now, if the coax cable is going down another piece of tubing, it's really not a coaxial system, it's a triaxial system. Let me drop. And if you're willing to spend the money, you can buy triaxial cable. It's cable where it's got a center conductor, an outer conductor to the center conductor, and another outer conductor after the inner outer conductor with another layer of dielectric material in there. Triaxial cable. So with your piece of mast with the coax cable going up, you're now creating triaxial cable. It has a calculatable impedance. The outer diameter of your coax and the inner diameter of your mast, you can plug that into a formula and find out what is the impedance of that. And even if the coax cable is flopping around a little bit inside, one of the things that's kind of magic about coax is that we all believe that the center conductor must be dead center in the middle of a coax cable for it to work. Absolutely not. You can make very non-symmetric cross-sectional coaxial cable. The center conductor can drift way off to one side, and until you start getting close enough to almost arc it over, the impedance goes down a little bit as you do that, but other than that, it's a good piece of coax cable. So so even your coax cable flopping around inside of your mast, let me drop it. That's still a triaxial system. And so now, although the coax cable is radiating, it's radiating inside of a mast where it can't radiate to the outside world. It's now got another layer of shielding around it. And so that's a pretty good technique. And let me think about that now. You're still making that outer conductor of the real coax cable hot. The length of it inside of the mast is now a length of coax cable that is running at, let me pick a number, 80 ohms of characteristic impedance. I know it's going to be higher impedance than your normal cable because the dielectric is there and the ratios are pretty large, diameter ratios. So it's going to be 80 ohm coax cable. So that number of wavelengths of 80 ohm coax cable inside of your mast, followed by the rest of your transmission line going back to the shack, that's all calculatable. The antenna is not going to suddenly crash and burn. It's just a little bit less desirable. And there probably are magic lengths of mast where you could run your coax cable inside
which can act as almost an RF choke on some of those frequencies. And there's ways that you can tune that. You can put a capacitor between the shield of the coax cable and your mast, where the coax cable is entering. You could put trans